This is Modeling Matters. I'm Tess Smith. Today, I have the great pleasure of interviewing my good friend, Sukrit Silas. Sukrit earned his PhD in Chemical and Systems Biology at Stanford, and his dissertation title is CRISPR Adaptation to RNA. Sukrit did his master's in pathology at Trinity College, Cambridge, and his bachelor's in molecular biology at Princeton. Towards the end of his PhD, Sukrit and two of his colleagues were accepted into the prestigious accelerator Y Combinator, and they launched two companies, Billion to One and Seek India, both of which focus on non-invasive prenatal diagnostics for detecting genetic disorders such as beta thalassemia. Is that how I say it?
Thalassemia.
Sorry, I need an assist
attempt.
On that one. Thank you, I appreciate
valid
it.
Attempt.
And Down syndrome. Sukrit was chief science officer of both companies and led clinical trials in India. And now Sukrit's back in the States and is currently a Damon Runyon Fellow at UCSF. And last but not least, in 2019, I didn't know this until I Google stalked you, Sukrit. Sukrit was named one of the Forbes 30 Under 30 in healthcare. Oh. I knew you'd groan if me mentioning that.
I'm mortified.
Sukrit hails from Delhi, India. He is an enthusiastic party host, enjoys drinking whiskey while listening to classical music, and he's one of my favorite storytellers. So, oh. Sukrit, welcome to Modeling Matters.
That's like the nicest introduction I've ever received. I'll tell everybody else to take notes.
Okay, good. Yes, yeah, so I'll make sure to send this to them. Well, I botched some parts in the middle, but, you know, good enough for government work. It's been so long since we chatted. I haven't seen you for all of this whole coronavirus. When you were at my house right before shelter in place started getting put in place, you were really worried about this. And you were especially worried about how this was going to play out in India.
Oh, yeah. I will not take full credit for that, though, right? Like, I definitely was one of those people sitting around in, like, February going, this is not going to be anything.
Yeah.
Until I think it was like the 20th of February when the paper came out that said, oh, this is the receptor for the virus. And I'm like, oh, crap, this isn't a cold. This is SARS. And then I called my mom and I was like, okay, you need to stay inside.
Yeah.
I think what's happened in the US is a fair sight worse than what one might have expected. You know, like naively, you know, like somebody who doesn't really know what's going on here, right? If you're looking from afar.
Yeah.
And you have an impression of the United States, right? Like, this is not the shit show, pardon my French, that anybody would have expected. What's happening in India is exactly the shit show that everybody would have expected.
Oh, no.
I was looking at the data, and I think, what was it? At least until, like, July, it was just an unconstrained exponential, right? Like, it's the curve a freshman in college studying, like, evolutionary biology would draw. It's just ripping through the population and nothing we do, right? Like, we're like, oh, we had such a great lockdown or whatever. Nothing we do is having even the slightest bit of impact. The one thing that is having impact, because if you look at the curve now, it has suddenly started decreasing really sharply, is that we are now approaching the US numbers, right? I mean, of course, right? Like, India is going to be, if not already has become, the number one sort of source of, like, all coronavirus infections in the world, right? Like, I wouldn't be surprised if, like, at the end of it, right, like, we have more than everybody else put together. But the government cannot allow that. So the moment it became clear to them that, like, we're going to overtake the US and we're going to be number one, the curve, you know, started dropping sharply. And that's just, you know, they're just rolling back testing and rolling back reporting. And I mean, you know, my parents work for the government, so I have this on, like, pretty good authority.
Wow. So it's really, yeah. it's not that it's actually dropping. It's that, like, the data is just not there.
No. Yeah. They are just being stifled. And it's hard to stifle this kind of data in, like, a country that large still, right? India's a very chaotic place. So,
yeah.
You know, a lot of places are still going to report. A lot of states are not going to, like, listen to the central government that, like, wants to get these numbers under control. But,
yeah.
I mean, there's nothing that we can actually do to get the actual numbers under control. It's literally just the numbers that are being brought under control.
Yeah, yeah. This pandemic, it's not exactly what you work on, but it's an adjacent topic to things that interest you. Has it changed your day-to-day research at all?
Yeah, this is a good question. It's something that I've thought about a fair bit. Before this started, the project that we just published and I'd been most aggressively working on was an unbiased survey of like RNA viruses in the oceans or like in one spice site in the ocean. When we came back with like thousands of new eukaryotic viruses, we were like, oh, well, yeah, I guess there are like things other than bacteria in the sea. And it turned out to be like a really fun collaboration with these people at the NIH who are like, you know, the experts at this kind of work. And we like ended up redefining the RNA viral tree of life. I mean, these kinds of things will become obsolete like before they're published, right? Because somebody else will publish another data set and somebody else will publish another tree and so on and so forth. But it was pretty close in the sense of there are a lot of these things out there and we've mostly just never seen any of them before. And, you know, we don't really even know how to look carefully enough. And then, yeah, suddenly this virus comes in and it takes over everything, right? I think in my own personal research, the attitude has been, you know, I do something else. So I'm going to keep doing that, except that they didn't let me into the lab for like 3 straight months. So I went and like volunteered at the coronavirus testing facility instead.
So you're at UCSF and UCSF has allocated a lot of its labs to help provide the equipment and reagents and all the processing necessary for coronavirus testing. How does that work? Yeah.
I think that's certainly the image that they would like to project. You know, like nobody knew what was going on, right?
Yeah.
Like this kind of thing is always easier to do in retrospect. But I mean, at the time it was, you know, Joe DeRisi and a few other people, he's the director of the BioHub and a few other things. And UCSF had the third floor in this building that I think was supposed to be a lab space and nothing had happened to it yet. It was literally just sort of scientists in the Bay Area going, all right, so the CDC is completely shitting the bed with this. I mean, again, you know, this is me speaking for them. So they're not responsible for my version of their words, but we needed testing, right? And these are people who understood that we needed testing. So, you know, the equipment was all like kind of begged, borrowed, stolen. You know, like two of our robots are from Zymergen. Another one came from like another company, like whoever had one of these things in the area were like, hey, can you loan it to us? You know, then like predictably, like all the suppliers ran out of like supplies to isolate the RNA from the viral samples and, you know, to purify them and whatever. And so that was a whole nightmare. We had to make some of that ourselves. Then we ran out of swabs and tubes. So we had to make those ourselves. So the swabs that you'll find now, like, you know, the nice thing about these swabs is, you know, you take the sample, you put it back into a tube and then you close the tube. Mm-hmm. And then you open the tube and you lift the cap out, like the little, you know, blunt end of the swab gets stuck in the cap, and then this, you can just remove the swab like in just the act of uncapping.
Got it.
The tube, right? And that's important because the robot's going to get confused when the swab is still in the sample. So the swabs all have to be taken out. The company that makes those swabs that like we used to get was in Italy, and Italy had just gone down. So yeah, we just couldn't get them, right? So then you had to use like sort of swabs that don't have that capability, but you also have run out of like the solution that you stabilize the virus samples into. So you make that solution or get that solution from however, then you build a robot, like a custom robot to dispense it into tubes. And then you have us, you know, like graduate students and postdocs, like putting stickers on tubes and capping those tubes. And sending them out to like Sonoma County or, you know, like the, or Marin County or whatever. And then they come back and we open them up and then we, you know, kind of go in there with like gloves and take the swabs out by hand before the robots can even get started. That was kind of like my thing, right? Like that whole process, like was the thing that I was like tech lead for.
Yeah.
It was a very home cooked operation, at least for the first few months. You know, now it's like there's funding and there are people that have been hired and stuff, but previously, it was just, you know, people you used to run into in lab, and now you're running into them in a slightly different lab and handing human samples. But other than that, you know, it was not much changed. You know, like I'm still thinking about RNA viruses the way I was before. I'm still just as careful as I used to be when I touched doorknobs. And
yeah, how did it feel to be a part of the effort to sort of improve the testing infrastructure, like especially in comparison to graduate research?
For the first couple of years of my grad school work, I was on my own, kind of like how I'm on my own now with the postdoc, right? Like people get involved when like things start working. This was different, obviously, right? Like I had a job and I thought I would probably like react badly to that, right? Like I'm kind of a pariah, like a voluntary pariah, right? Like I kind of love being out there by myself doing my own thing. honestly, it was a really great experience, right? Like, I was part of a team. We were supposed to get this thing done. We were getting it done. You know, we were constantly kind of like figuring out like small procedural changes to make things faster. And yeah, it was like this cog that fit into a larger machine. And it was really fun and it was really rewarding. And I'm really glad I did it. I mean, I did it to get out of the house, honestly, right? Like, it's not like, especially in the Bay Area, there's a lot of talent, right? Like, there are many people who can run these kinds of assays. You know, I should be grateful that I was allowed to be part of that rather than the other way around, right?
You've got like real life skills.
Well, I have real life skills for a once in a century pandemic, right? Like, yes, that sounds about right. That was where I would have ranked my usefulness to society even before coronavirus.
How did you first become interested in biology?
Honestly, I was in college. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I was a physicist for a little while. I thought about history. You know, somebody told me that I should, you know, think about becoming an investment banker because I was at Princeton and that's like, you know, there are enough of these people walking around telling you that you should think about becoming an investment banker. And I took Econ 101 or something and quit it after like 2 weeks because, honestly, my first summer rolled around. I had no plans. I didn't know that it was a thing to have plans for the summer. And people were like, what are you going to do? I was like, I don't know, go home, I guess. And they were like, wait, you're not going to do like an internship or something? And I was like, what? There was this like lab that took me in and it was headed by like just, you know, one of the best people alive. He was just so great that I just kept going. That was how I picked my major, honestly.
I mean, those are some great credentials. Best person alive. I hope this
best person alive. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I hope they have that like on their CV.
He also has a Nobel Prize, but you know, like I think the best person alive matters a lot more.
It's true. So, you know, being that I know you outside of this interview, you tend to have a lot of friends who are physicists. Mm-hmm. Why is this?
I don't know. Physicists are my favorite people. I'm not, I do just chalk this up to the fact that I was, you know, a physicist until I took this class at Princeton called Classical Mechanics B. Everybody else told you to take Classical Mechanics A, but, you know, me and some of my friends, like, just group thought ourselves into taking B. We all got Cs, except for David. That class finally killed my inner child, you know, and I stopped being a physicist at that point. But it's a really compelling way to think of the world. When you think of the world in terms of biology or even non-scientific disciplines, really, when you're a lawyer thinking about the world or an anthropologist thinking about the world, you tend to see like sort of one sort of pronounced aspect of it, right? You tend to see certain distributions, certain processes over and over again. So, you know, like if you're a biologist like me, right, like you're going to see a heck of a lot of Poisson processes, lots of normal distributions, like things like that, right? And I'm really glad that I got that initial exposure to like physics and an introduction to not all the distributions that exist in the universe, but like many of them, right? Like so that when you look at a process, like a biological process, still a physical process, and you say, oh, what's going on here, right? Like you have an intuitive sense that says, for a process that kind of like smells like this, I would expect this kind of mathematical dynamics at its heart, right? Like, or I should think of this in terms of an emergent statistical phenomenon, right? Or here I should think of this in terms of something else. And I don't know, like, yeah, whenever I see that in somebody else, right, like, I think we, like, instantly connect. I think that's why a lot of my friends are physicists.
I mean, I think the classic joke with the physicists is they always think of everything as a harmonic oscillator, as a spring.
Right.
And we have the privilege of, you know, of being fortunate enough to be able to do that with a lot of our systems. But for you, a lot of your subject matter, everything's interwoven and intertwining and... how do you even start to get a handle on a system that is so complicated or has so many moving parts?
Yeah, no, exactly, right? Like I'm very far away from the harmonic oscillator. I can tell you, oh, I am so excited because I can look at these dynamics and it looks like there's only one thing involved. Hallelujah. You know, like but I mean, it's not that bad, right? Like I have like friends who are lawyers and we like often will like compare biology and law and how they're like
actually
pretty analogous things, right? Like, I mean, maybe sometimes in reverse if you think of like writing laws or whatever, but you know, you in biology, you have a complicated system, you can poke it. and you can say, hey, what are the rules that like govern your behavior when I poke you? And in, you know, kind of like when you're writing laws, you're like kind of doing the opposite thing. It's still a messy, complicated system, right? But you're trying to write down rules and trying to anticipate what all the various kind of implications of those things can be. And I think like the same kind of reasoning that helps like legal thinking is what makes like biological experiments possible, right? Like you kind of, yes, it is far too complicated. There are black boxes everywhere and everything, every little choice that you make will influence your results. But you just have to craft your experiments in a way that you can believe what comes out of them. It's about asking the right question, or maybe like asking like a slightly less than right question and then asking another question that shaves off that part of uncertainty from it. But even small things like open up so many possibilities. That's what makes this possible, right? Like you just sort of figure out small, tiny things along the way and you see the tree of possibilities. They kind of like expand in front of you. So it's not all, oh, chaos and disorder and we just have to protect ourselves from it. There are lots of possible paths. You choose the ones that seem most interesting and you just keep doing that over and over again.
It sounds like you have to be very observant and you have to really check your assumptions.
Yeah. The right way to do this is like, you know, you're in the shower and suddenly it occurs to you, oh, I really should keep those things cold before I mix them or like wash them before, you know, like those kinds of like small technical things mm-hmm. will completely like make the difference between like a good experiment and a bad experiment. And I don't think you can do a good experiment unless you're like thinking about that kind of thing constantly.
So you had to learn how to construct a good experiment, how to ask a good question. So if we go back to your time at Princeton and we go back to your first experience in a lab, was this a biology lab that you were in summer?
Yeah.
Okay. And what did you work on and what did you do?
I was working on fruit fly embryos. There was a particular membrane that this postdoc was working with. He had found that like there were cells in this particular membrane in the fruit fly embryo that were like pulsing in a particular way. And he wanted me as the undergraduate student who, you know, had been foisted upon him that summer to see if that would happen in another process somewhere else in the embryo, like later on in development. And we're looking at that and trying to look at these like tiny cells, and the thing was just like, you know, moving across the embryo, like always it would like go out of plane of the microscope, and it was really frustrating. And then right next to that process is the giant membrane with like, you know, like huge cells that were also pulsing. And I was like, wait, why don't we look at those cells instead? They're also doing the thing and they're so much bigger. And Adam was like, yeah, that's an excellent idea. So that's what I worked on then for like 3 years or so. But I was not a good scientist back then, right? Like when I finished at Princeton, Professor Vishas told me, you know, you go to graduate school to learn how to think like a scientist. And I was like kind of offended because I was like, wait, the implication being I don't know how to think like a scientist. And I mean, of course he was right, right? Like, I mean, like he was the kind of person who like says things that you then keep in your back pocket because like 6 years later, you're going to understand, you know, just how right he was. You know, somebody told me the story of sea captain who's trying to bring the vessel in through the estuary or whatever, right? And the first mate or whatever says, well, how do you know, right, where the rocks are or whatever, right? Like, why are you not using like the little rope and the little thing and the instruments and stuff? And he says, because I just have a feel for it. Often people who just have the feel for it end up deciding that, you know, that's the only way that this can be done. And that's obviously not true, right? Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, clearly, like, there's some process by which they arrived at that feel for the system. And if we had computational system like sophisticated enough or an understanding of the system that we're studying sophisticated enough, we might be able to say, oh, you know, this is kind of how you navigate this estuary, right? It's like the equivalent of having sonar, but like we don't really have sonar in biology at all, anywhere close. And yeah. So this kind of like intuitive sense really matters. Honestly, like, I don't know, right? Like the only way to learn is to watch somebody do it. And that's where the mentorship and the training comes into play again, right? Like, especially at Stanford, watching my advisor for 5 years, you know, just kind of like have this knack for like seeing things. Part of that intuition is you have to know kind of like where it's strong and where it's weak. This is why people specialize, right? Like it's because it's not possible to have, I think, general like scientific intuition. I think it might be possible to have general kind of like biological intuition, but that takes like decades to develop. Because I mean, it's like watching somebody do magic, right? Like when I would watch Andy kind of like just like guess the answer over and over again.
When you started being more right than he was that when it was time to graduate? Is that kind of how you knew, or like how did that transition kind of occur? When did you feel like, oh wait, I think now I'm a scientist?
Right. I think he did an excellent job with that, right? Like it's like, because I think after my like first big result, right? Like when I like clearly knew what the system was doing, he kind of just like backed away from the whole thing. You know, I had like a bunch of other observations that I wanted to pin down, and I found collaborators to like pin them down with. You know, close to the end of the PhD, there were papers that, you know, he was like almost reading as an outside observer, which was really, really helpful, because, you know, then it's not just like, you know, me and the other type 3 CRISPR biologists sort of like in the weeds, and he just like, you know, like just deletes your abstract and then, you know, starts typing it like from a very general, like, you know, sense from the beginning kind of thing.
It sounds like your relationship with Andy was very dynamic, that it changed a lot throughout your graduate career.
Yeah.
What were some of the things that, I don't know, stood out to you as kind of the most helpful?
Okay, so, you know, I like to tell this story this way, right? Like, I feel like my undergrad mentor, he like kind of taught me to trust the experiment. If you've done the experiment and you think you've like taken all the precautions and you've controlled it well, and you've asked a lot of people and they think you've controlled it well too, or whatever, right? Like, and then you get the data. There's this tendency that people have to just, you know, hold their head and say, ah, it's so messed up and noisy and there's so much going on and how is this ever going to make sense or whatever, right? Like he was like, no, don't do that. Once the data are in front of you, you look at it, right? Like you sit down patiently and you look at it and you try and make sense of it, right? It's like this like calm sort of like, well, you did the experiment, now look at the data. So yeah, Fresavicius taught me to trust the experiment. Andy taught me to trust the theory. You know, like it was like one step further, where now it's not just kind of like, okay, well, I did the experiment, I'm looking at the thing and I'm reacting to like what the thing did, right? Like now I was kind of sitting there saying, well, you should do this. And then I'd do the experiment and the system would not do that. And I was like, how dare you, you know? and then you come back and you'd say, okay, well, what did I miss, right? Like, because this should happen, right? So you can actually like draw yourself up to your full height and say, well, this is how it should work. And then you can use that to like craft experiments. And that was like a really, really powerful thing to learn. But, you know, honestly, if you're asking me like, what were the most useful things that I learned from Andy, right? Like maybe more than half of them would have been like on a more functional level, how to run a lab and how to treat your colleagues and how to manage people or whatever. But also on a less functional level, or maybe more functional level, how to like be a good person, you know, like how to go through life and treat other people. And it was, you know, like the second sort of formative experience, right? Like after college or whatever in my life, it changed who I am for the better.
So had you not gone into biology, what else do you think you might have been interested in?
Yeah, probably something like law or physics or history, you know, like not math, not like a closed system, right? Like I think I've always been like fascinated by things where there's an independent, beautiful thing that you can think about and you can like ask it questions, and it's, you know, kind of like endlessly varied and endlessly fascinating. I love scuba diving. I love untouched beaches, like those kinds of things. So in some sense, it was always kind of going to be, this was where I would end up. Mm-hmm. Right. It's so much more proximal than like cosmology or whatever. It's right here.
Yeah.
I can pick it up. I can look at it. I can, you know, maybe do experiments with it. I can try and figure out how it works. And it's endlessly fascinating. We will never run out of like things to discover in the natural living world, no matter how hard we try. The complexity of living systems, right? Like it's almost like religious for me. I get high on this stuff, right? Like when I get like rejected, I go outside and I look at a tree and I think about like all the fantastic like dynamics that must be going on inside. It's really good training for life in general, right? Like you know, anytime you find yourself making like a theory that like puts you at the center of the universe, right? Like you should be very scared. Because odds are you've made a massive mistake somewhere, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you take a step back, you observe, you learn to admit that you're wrong, and yet you sort of keep going and keep trying because it's cool and it's fascinating, and you know, like you're so sure there's something there.
So it's a combination of the humility, but also the curiosity and really wanting to understand it.
That's such a good way to put it, right? Like, and I think like for the kind of person that I am, and I think the humility, curiosity, like version of things, right? Like is a much healthier, much more like Andy like version of living your life than like the other sort of side of this, which is just like ambition, right? Wanting to do something great. Like, of course we do. One of the most important things that I learned in grad school was like, there's a right way to do that. And that's the kind of person I want to be, right? Like where you are a human being first, you're not always going to think that your work is like, you know, the most exciting thing ever, right? And when that happens, your life is not going to lose meaning. Like sometimes other people will beat you to things. Sometimes you'll beat other people to things, and you're not going to like take that as a hostile sort of interaction, right? In either direction. We really are all in this together, right? Like we're all just trying to like figure out more about the world. I'm a scientist, right? Like, so like the way to like convince me of something is to show me that this is actually like a more functional way of doing something. I think I used to be very kind of like, all right, this is what needs to be done. I'm going to do it and nobody's going to get in my way. And if it doesn't like behave, then like the system, right? Then I'm going to like keep relentlessly hitting it. The other way is actually more functional. It is actually more likely to yield results. It is actually more likely to like, you know, let you kind of like see the right answer if you're looking at it in the wrong way, instead of just battling at the problem, right? Like you kind of like have to learn to like remove yourself from the equation. It's also like much more likely to keep you sane and happy, right? Which is a pretty big part of this too, right? Like you're not going to be doing good science if you're like stressed and unhappy all the time and depressed. You know, it detaches you from your from the success and failure of your experiments. Like Andy did this thing, right? Like where he has never, ever said anything to me except, you know, whenever like I'd walk in and say, oh, this thing I was trying for like 6 months, like finally works. Or like, you know, I like figured out such a clever way to like, you know, solve this like problem. Or like, I finally got that plasmid out. Like good. You know, no emotion, like no celebrations, right? We publish our paper in science or whatever. Like, I think when I finally solved like the big problem, right? Like it was like, oh, good, very good, excellent, right? Like that's as far as he ever got.
Because in his view, was it kind of like part of the process? Is that
exactly? Yeah. But like on the other hand, it was like also, you know, when I came in frustrated, going like, oh, this is not working. Mm. He'd be like, okay, so maybe this is what's going on, right? Like that was the first sentence out of his mouth. There was not even an acknowledgement that like something bad is happening. Then, you know, over like 2 or 3 years of like being exposed to this, I just learned that like, you know, when I walk into his office, I'm just sort of trying to figure out what the system is doing, right? Like with a fellow scientist, right? Like there was no like ego attached to it, right? Like my successes and failures had nothing to do with my sense of self-worth. It was just like, we'd asked a question, it had given us an answer or not an answer. And we were going to like figure out what to ask next, right? Like it was just that, you know, if I were a sprint runner before, I became a marathon runner after. Yeah. And I think that's where the humility and curiosity like version of this is better, right? Like it'll let you see things and let you like approach things in a more consistent, more sort of sustainable manner. And it'll keep you happy.
Now I'd like to ask you a bit about your experiences with Y Combinator, with your startups, and kind of contrast that with your life as a researcher. So First of all, how did it even come to be that you guys wanted to do this startup? Who was involved? What happened there?
Yeah, no, I mean, I remember when I first told you that oh yeah, like our company's at YC now, and you and a lot of other of my friends were like, wait, you have a YC company? That was like the last person that anybody expected, you know, knowing me, to have ended up in that situation.
The way I describe it is that you were begrudgingly living the Silicon Valley dream.
Yes, I in retrospect, I probably should have been more grateful at the time, but.
I think you were. I think you were yeah. Also trying to kind of wrap it in, you know, with some humility and things like that.
Yeah, so it was,
there were many reasons for the way that you would express it.
Yeah, no, it was a whirlwind, right? Like it was so different from everything that I had known, and I learned so much. Like, I mean, you know, I would never kind of like replay my life and not do that. you know, changed the way that I think of the world, because I think I just have a much better understanding of it now than, you know, the 10 years that I spent like fancy universities before, you know, like they didn't adequately prepare me for how the rest of the world operates. Like, what? Who would have thought? I mean, how did it start? Honestly, like one of my really, really good friends from Princeton and I, like, you know, he was at Stanford too, and we would like hang out in his dorm room a lot and talk about stuff. And I don't know, I think we were like drunk some night, and he was saying, or I was saying, I don't even remember who was saying it, that, you know, the person who brings like sequencing technologies to like developing countries will make like a lot of money. And then the other person was like, wait, why don't we do that? But we're both from developing countries. He's from Turkey and I'm from India. That's kind of like where it really started, right? Like, it, obviously, like, that's not what we ended up doing at all, right? Like, the plan was to, you know, make a foray into initially Turkey, but then Turkey had the coup and everything, the fake coup, you know, that quickly dampened our and, you know, the presumptive investors in interest in funding anything there. And so we started thinking like pretty seriously about India. And then we said, okay, well, if we wanted to be like the one-stop shop for like DNA sequencing services type things in India, right? Like, what would we start with, right? Like, what's the gateway drug really, right? We don't want to be snake oil salesmen. We want to sell something that actually like is useful and matters. I think the month after I published my paper from the PhD, I flew back home for a month, and I, you know, went and like talked to a bunch of gynecologists and doctors, and then trying to see like kind of like what they needed, right? Like, what's the one thing that'll like really make a difference here? Gynecology, because it tends to be very price insensitive. People care a lot about their kids. And yeah, we had like all these weird ideas about how we're going to detect like every disease. And, you know, the doctor was like, what are we going to do with every disease, right? We want like thalassemia. And we're like, what is thalassemia?
That was going to be my question. What is thalassemia?
Yeah. you know, sickle cell disease, right? Yeah. Like, it's like, yeah, like the canonical story of if you are a carrier, which means you have one broken copy of this gene, but not the other one's fine, then you're somewhat resistant to malaria. And if you have both broken copies of the gene, you have the disease, and, you know, then there's like trouble in terms of like getting oxygen from your lungs to your tissues because it's in the hemoglobin gene. Thalassemia is the class of disorder. Sickle cell anemia is one version of thalassemia. Thalassemia is everything that can go wrong in this way. So like, you know, there are like varying grades of severity, varying prognoses or whatever, right? But I think the five most common mutations in India that are severe basically mean that you're going to not survive past like a few years, often like a few months into being born, because you're born into these rural contexts and you have no idea what's wrong with the kid. And, you know, you need transfusions every 2 weeks. Where are you going to get transfusions every 2 weeks? And the child just dies. You know, the government had been trying for years to like set up some sort of testing infrastructure. But unfortunately, all you can do is really test the parents. And not really know what the risk of the fetus itself is past like the 25% that you would just infer from genetics. And at that point, you have to do an invasive test. You know, I mean, it's invasive and it's somewhat risky, but at least in the US, like, you have machines to do that, right? In India, there are like 12 places that can do that test. And that means you have to put this person on a train to Delhi or to, you know, Hyderabad or whatever, where they will go and then get this test done. It's there. It's just not available broadly, and you really need like a way to like get more confidence with, you know, something like a blood test. So that's what we like set out to build. I mean, there were like two aspects of it, right? Like, one was actually three aspects of it. Like, one was kind of like the actual like building of the test and the science of it, and trying to do that for the medical environment that exists in India, where nobody has insurance, everything is out of pocket. People will still pay when it's their kid's health or whatever, but they won't pay that much, right? Because there's just not enough money in the system. So what we build has to be cheap. What we build has to be something that people and doctors there understand. And that was like one whole set of challenges that I was just like completely unprepared for and didn't even like know about until I landed there, right? That, like, so that's like one part of the story where I'm from there. I speak the language. I speak the language idiomatically, right? Like I I'd be sitting in somebody's office and telling them, you know, oh, this is who I am. And then we have like such a great idea and we have all the money that we could care to spend. And, you know, we don't want you to go out of your way at all. And, you know, like, won't you want to partner with us? This is going to be so great. And, you know, we're going to build this amazing thing and it's going to help everybody. And they would just look at me because I was speaking their language, but I had clearly, like, you know, just dropped from an alien planet, like, because that's just not how you talk there, right? Professionally, like the culturally, like, that's just not how you conduct business in India. Right. And so it was this, like, very weird, like, reverse culture shock, right? Because I, like, professionally, I'm an American, right? Like, this is, I know how to operate in this system. I do not know how to operate in India.
Oh, that's fascinating.
I, like, at some point, I hired a person who had spent 20 years in government. And I was like, I'm going to triple your salary, and you're going to just come with me to everything. And listen to what the person's saying and tell me afterwards what the hell they were actually talking about. because I have no clue what's going on. Like, you know, kick me out of the table to make me stop. And sometimes he'd kick me and I wouldn't stop because I was so frustrated. And it was like, you know, it was like exactly the wrong way to conduct myself. The thing is, you understand everybody's perspectives, right? Like, the person who's refusing to let me do the trial in India, right? They're 3 months away from retirement. I didn't know this. When I started talking to them, I wasted 6 weeks talking to them, right? But they were never going to approve anything. You know, so the luxury that you have in science, where you walk into somebody's office and you know what their incentives are, right? They want to publish, just the way that you want to publish, right? You know that the moment you walk in the door. You do not have that in industry. You certainly don't have that in India, where, like, I don't know, people's incentives are just fucking crazy. you know, the place is wild. I'm from there, so I can say this. And then you're in Silicon Valley, and there are these investors, and they're giving you their own personal money, right? Because we're not raising institutional capital at this point, right? Like, these are angel investors, like, people who just made their own money, and they want, like, to drop $250,000, you know, somewhere where they think it's, you know, going to make a return, but also make a difference, right? Like, these are, like, people with their own, incentives and intentions and life experiences that are being brought to the table. And then you have to stand in front of them and say, yeah, you know, like, give us the $250,000 while you can see the shit show that's happening at home. And it was hard, right? Because you don't want to lie to them. You don't want to say, you know, like, misrepresent what's going on. But you also want to, like, not, like, make it sound like everything's fucked, because then you're just not going to get the investment. And I mean, I don't know, like, I think one thing that worked really well, at least for me, in the limited interactions that I had with investors, my co-founder, for example, he used to handle most of them, was to just say, hey, look, you know, like, this is kind of, like, these are the places that I've been, and this is the kind of work that I've been doing. I could have gone anywhere. I chose to do this instead. Right? Like, so, you know, you're putting your money, I'm putting in my time. Can I tell you that this is really, like, going to, like, you know, work? Like, honestly, no. But I'm putting something on the line as well. And that, you know, that I think that tended to, like, resonate, I think, with the people there. What would happen when you took, like, investors' money was, in science, you sit there and you say, oh, you know, gee, like, why is the sky blue, right? Like, I'm at A, like, what about X? Mm-hmm. And the moment you've taken somebody's money, like, they want to see a return on it. Of course they want to see a return on it, right? Like, you understand that. So you don't get to wonder, like, where X is anymore, right? You're at A, B is too far. 8.5 seems to be the closest way to market, so you go for 8.5. It's not a value judgment, right? Like, it is just how it has to be. And it was extremely useful for me to see that part of the world, you know, and to understand how that works, right? And that kind of, like, gets me to the third thing, which is the third part of the story, which is 6 months, like, on the other side of a corporate bank account, and suddenly, you know, all that, like, Econ 101 stuff that I was just not, you know, interested in, and, you know, inflation and financing and interest rates, and, like, what is going on, and why do corporations behave in these ways, right? Like, why are they so, you know, you want to grab them by the shoulders and shake them and say, like, why are you doing this? Yeah. Like, this is obviously not the right decision, you know, like, from a societal point of view, whatever. 6 months on the other side of the corporate bank account, you understand exactly why companies act the way that they do. You got to keep the lights on, right? Like, and especially if you're a founder, right? Like, the people who work for you expect their paychecks. The people who are giving you the money expect their results. And you're kind of, like, in the middle of it, right? Like, you're the only people who can see just, like, what an absolute shit show the whole thing is. I think I definitely came away from the whole thing with, like, a lot more respect for how that works, right? Like, I mean, if you have something that you want to sell online, go to Y Combinator, man. Like, there's nobody who knows how to do that better than those people do, right? Like, I thought it was just, you know, the successful startups go to YC and then they get successful and YC gets successful. And then, you know, it's just like a cycle that repeats itself. That is not true. They definitely know what they're doing. Like, in certain spheres, there were a lot of good ideas in our batch. you know, so it was kind of inspiring, especially when somebody like me who was coming at it begrudgingly had to admit that.
Like, oh, I guess these people are really cool. I guess that's
Yeah. At least a third of them were really cool.
So if I was to even attempt to summarize mm-hmm. kind of the message from all these amazing stories that you've told me about this startup experience, it's, you know, the culture shock that you experienced going back home. Like, that's not the story people usually tell, but that mm-hmm. the way business is done in the United States is just substantially different from how business is done in India. And this makes a huge difference with getting anything done, particularly if you, you know, need to run a clinical trial.
Right.
And then there's sort of learning how to do business in the United States itself, working with investors, working, you know, how do you faithfully represent the state of affairs in a company, you know, because I think as scientists we're very prone to like very much understating things. Like, well, we're not sure about this. We don't think this is going to work.
Exactly.
And not really, that's not the culture. That's not the expectation. So you kind of have to translate to business speak.
Exactly. Yeah.
So how could you do that while maintaining your integrity as a scientist?
Yeah.
But also learning how to interact in that sphere. And then, you know, last but not least, just the mechanics of how do you actually run a company?
Yeah.
How does the economy work?
How the economy works. Yeah. Like responsibilities to like employees and laws around that. Right. Like, realized that these things we'd signed were like actual legal contracts. You know, when I like finally left the startup, right, I was like, oh crap, like these are legal contracts. And, you know, like you have to be careful when like kind of like navigating your exit because you signed things and that means something in a very real sense. So like lots of life lessons, right? It was like my crash course in like real life.
And maybe at this point it's a perfect time to kind of transition. So you're not currently doing you're not involved in the day-to-day operations of the startup anymore. It's still operating.
Yeah.
So now you're back in research. Mm-hmm. So what made you come back? Mm-hmm. How did that happen?
Yeah, no, I mean,
absolutely. What are you doing now?
The company's, you know, like, you know, knock on wood, like doing quite well. It's, you know, the tests that we developed, like, unfortunately we weren't really able to like launch them in India as quickly as we would have hoped, but they're on the market here. They're on the market in Europe. And you know, new things are in the pipeline. There's one more trial that I'd set up in India before I left, and that's should, you know, finish soon. And that's going to lead to like one more product. And I think that'll be like the formal sort of end of my involvement with the startup. Why I left is exactly because of that, like, why is the sky blue thing, right? Like the kind of like being at A and wondering about X thing. Like you very quickly, when you take somebody's money and have to operate within the constraints of like, you know, a business that has liabilities, like, you know, and your accounts being drained every month. And I mean, you have a bunch of money and you can do experiments a lot more easily than you could in scientific research, because we're significantly more cash strapped than scientific research. But you have to be even more careful about like which direction you pick, because, you know, turning like a research project around is possible, right? Like it's still you and you can decide to do something else. Turning a company around is really like really hard. You know, I know people in Silicon Valley love talking about pivots, but pivots are hard. You know, like to this day, like we are still doing the thing that we set out to do, right? From the first thing that we said, investors, is what the company is doing. It's been like almost 5 years. I wanted that Blue Horizons thinking again, this time knowing what a privilege it is to be allowed to do that at all. Because it's not just that there are like very few professions where you can do this, there are also very few places in the world where you can do this, like in a sensible way, right? Like, unfortunately, I would not try and do this in India. Like, you know, the scientific establishment there is just not mature enough to do any sort of really meaningful research, at least in biology. You know, once the initial trial was over and we knew that we'd be able to secure like Series A funding based on that, on those results, right? Because then we had a product that worked. Which like it was a you know, I had a conversation with Ogzan actually in a car, and he was like, this is less about the company and more about like what kind of life do you want? And I think I chose the life of being able to go out and like, you know, look at a tree and say, oh, this is cool. I wonder why. It kind of gave me perspective for what kind of projects to work on as a postdoc as well, right? Like, very popular way to do this is if you've been successful in your PhD, right? Like pick like something like safe but high impact. for a postdoc in like a, you know, a fancy institution, and then, you know, publish like a couple big deal papers out of it, and then set up your own lab and then figure things out. And I think the lesson for like how hard it is to pivot, right, like has really stuck with me. So like, I'm not, you know, I'm not going to like do one thing in order to be able to do another thing, right? Like if I'm interested in the oceans, or if I'm interested in like, you know, like the evolutionary diversity of like something that, that I'm interested in, right? Like that's the thing to go after, right? Like, and go after it now while it's right in front of you and you have the resources and the capacity to do it. And right? Like, you'll find a way, like don't wait for the next thing. And yeah, like I came back because the kind of thing that I wanted to do would just not be possible in industry, right? Like say for like very, very limited context, like I don't know if Google like actually put together like a life sciences division that was truly blue skies, then maybe, but you know, short of something like that, like, you know, you don't get to ask these questions anywhere outside of academia, at least in biology. The thing that I'm like specifically thinking about right now is there are, you know, thousands of viruses that we know of that infect bacteria, at least we have their genomes. We have tens of thousands of genes. We don't know what most of them do. we don't know where to start. And, you know, these things are incredibly hard to like grow. And if you go to all the trouble of growing one of them, then how do you know that there's going to be something interesting in that system at the end? There's plenty of material and you just don't know where to start. We think we have a way to at least prioritize, you know, in a specific way, kind of like which genes to go after, these like thousands of viruses and like tens of thousands of genes. Like if you could only pick like 200 to study, because even that's a lot, which 200 would they be? So I've been working this year on like an algorithm to like kind of like pick them. And this is what keeps me up at night, because it's just something we made up. And you know, you could just completely be wrong, but it's the kind of like risky project that like I came back to do, right? Like we'll just order these genes, we'll grow them up, and we'll do everything that we can think of to see if they do anything interesting. And we'll see where that takes us. They tell you not to do fishing expeditions. This is as fishing expedition-y a research project as they get.
Is it a fishing expedition that's guided by your intuition for these problems? Is your algorithm sort of like the encoding of this intuition that you've been building through your previous research?
The intuition plays a part in the final selection, but that's a good point. The algorithm is based on this like realization that people have had, I think, like in even way far back in the 70s or whatever, right? Like that these viruses, the viruses that infect bacteria, right? Like they store information in their genomes in a very organized manner. Things kind of like genes are encoded in a physical order, and that order is conserved, and it has to do with like evolution and how these things are regulated or whatever. What people noticed a long time ago was sometimes that order was broken, right? Like, so there'd be like highly conserved, contiguous blocks of genetic information, and suddenly like this like crazy region where like God knows what's going on, and then order would resume. At least in the case of this like one class of very well-studied viruses, right? Like somebody realized that one of the genes in one of these like, you know, hypervariable regions was something that like, it was this like protein missile. It was like the small protein missile that was packed, actually packed inside the virus, right? Like the virus usually injects its DNA into the cell.
Yeah.
And the virus was injecting a bunch of proteins in there as well, because it wanted the protein there first thing, because that protein would then find the bacterial immune system and disable it. And there were a bunch of other genes there, and people tried to look at like a couple more of them, and nobody could figure out what they did. And, you know, by the time the sequencing technologies became available that like got us this, like the genetic information of tens of thousands of viruses, the field had kind of moved on. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm saying is, you know, like, wait, let's go back to that idea, right? Like, because if I can, in an unbiased way, right? Like, I know nothing about these genes at all, right? I'm not like relying on anything that we know. I'm just saying, I want to look at the most disordered parts of the genomes in these like viral families. And maybe that's where the missile defense system is, right? Like, because I'm not really as interested in the housing department for this phage blueprint, right? Like, I don't really care how it, like, and again, you know, like my apologies to people who like study this kind of thing, but like how the phage constructs its capsid or whatever, that's also very cool. The conflict between the phage and its host bacterium, mm-hmm. is what's interesting. So the hope is that by looking at these like hypervariable regions, we'd be able to like prioritize genes to study, like genes that are likely to mess with the bacteria, right? Like maybe this leads to like something like an antibiotic. Maybe this leads to, you know, discovering like a new immune system in bacteria. Maybe it needs to, I don't know, all sorts of things, interphage warfare, you know, like all sorts of cool stuff could happen. But we're trying to go in without bias.
And so these are the sequences that you're looking at are the viral sequences.
Yes, yes, yes.
And is the idea that if they traditionally have a specific order, mm-hmm. that if you see something that doesn't have that order, well, that thing must have been pretty cool in order to have kind of shooken things up and to have been preserved through that lineage.
Yeah, yeah. If you imagine each virus is like a string, because that's what their DNA is. It's like literally a physical string, right? Like that has like information coded in its composition. And you just like walk along the string, right? And you're doing this for like 10 viruses at the same time, and these 10 viruses are basically identical. As you're walking along, the moment like funky things start happening, that's where you start to become suspicious, because one of the reasons that the funky things could be happening is that the virus is like kind of like locked in this like battle with its host, right? It's trying to infect the host is trying to evolve away, the virus is trying to like counter that, the host comes up with an immune system, the virus counters that, the host comes up with like a regulatory mechanism that detects when the immune system is disabled and then does something else, you know, like that kind of thing. So it's a much more dynamic process than the evolution of like, you know, the capsid or the tail of the virus or whatever.
Right.
And so it's under that evolutionary pressure that things are changing, and therefore they're changing a lot faster and they're being swapped around. And it's like, you know, the swapping is the predominant mode, I think, of the variation. And if you can see that happen, then maybe you're looking at a region of the viral genome that is under pressure for some reason. And the hope is that that pressure is coming from like from the host. That's why these regions vary so much. And if that's true, then you have like a way to a priori look at a viral genome without having done any experiments and say, I mean, a set of viral genomes, you can't do this with just one, and say, oh, the interesting stuff is here. And if I want to know what defines sort of the viral host interaction in this niche, in this evolutionary niche, is it like mostly CRISPR? Is it mostly like restriction modification systems? Is it mostly barrier defenses? Like, what's the story here, right? Like, what fight is this host pathogen system fighting?
It's then quite dramatic.
Just, yeah.
It's quite dramatic when you put it that way. Yeah.
Yeah.
All these battles waging on the microscopic scale.
Yeah. The oldest fight and the longest running fight and the most predominant fight on this planet by far. You know, this is like how every conference about this kind of thing starts, right? Like somebody will get up on stage and tell you just how many viruses there are in the ocean and how many cells are killed every day, and you know, how there are like some versions of this that you can see from space. And this is like by far like the thing that like happens on this planet more than anything else. And like nobody cares, but that's fine.
I mean, it's good to have different perspectives.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Especially when there's like, you know, flesh eating bacteria on your arm and you really, really need it to go away.
I'm just imagining that advertisement. It's like, do you have a flesh-eating bacteria on your arm? Do you need it to just go away? Call Sucrit.
Donate to your local phage biologist today.
You love to host parties.
Mm-hmm.
And you love to have different friend groups. And you love to invite these people from different friend groups to your parties to see them mingle.
Yes.
Why is this?
Well, okay, so I painted a very rosy picture of Stanford. Let me walk that back a little bit. Stanford was depressing and miserable and lonely. No, it was you know, not quite my speed. I think I'd spent the year before at Cambridge, which was like honestly one of the most fun years of my life. You know, then I spent like 5 years at Stanford not having the most fun in my life. Like personally, professionally, it was great, right? Like it's like more than anything I could ever have asked for. And I think, yeah, I just like left that experience with a lot of lessons that once I was done with the startup in India, like I wanted to put into practice here, right? Like I'd realized kind of like I am the kind of person who's happiest around people, lots of different kinds of people. And, you know, what I'd seen at Cambridge was lots of different kinds of people coming together and like forming these like really enduring friendships and bonds. I mean, that's partially like how you and I met, right? Like,
yeah,
it's,
yeah.
By extension, it was so effortless there, right? And I kept wondering what made it so effortless there and so much work at Stanford, right? Like to the point that it was like basically impossible. And then how much of an impact that it had on me and like on, you know, friends of mine who were also going through sometimes like very similar experiences of like isolation. The hypothesis that I had was it's the repeated interaction, right? Like, so the nice thing about Cambridge was every week, like you'd sit down for a formal dinner and, you know, people just show up And, you know, after 3 months, you've seen them like 10 times. And that's like more than enough, right? Like to like for sometimes for like lifelong friendships, especially because the people were so excellent to begin with. So that was the inspiration, right? Like I was like, okay, you know, I'm going to bribe people with food. I had moved into this house that used to be a restaurant before. We had a big kitchen. My cooking skills could have used some brushing up anyway. So I just started inviting, like, you know, first it was just my friends. Then, you know, you go to other people's parties and then you like find their friends and you invite those people over too. Anytime you meet somebody interesting, right? Like when like San Francisco is like very kind of like tech and whatever, but it's also very bohemian. It's very scientific. It's very literary. It's very like, you know, like there are people doing all sorts of extremely interesting things here. And, you know, like these are the same people that I was having these conversations with in college and at Cambridge. So why couldn't we do it here, right? Like, there's nothing wrong with the Bay Area per se, right? Like, anyway, I mean, I did think there was something wrong with the Bay Area at Stanford. I had to take a step back as a scientist and say, no, that can't be it, right? Like, there is an answer here.
So basically, Andy's teachings taught you that, you know, maybe
yeah,
if you need to step back and
look again,
look at the model, you know, trust the theory.
Yeah, and so we did, and I just like started like hosting dinners, and I'd like cook a bunch of food and call people over and ask them to bring like bottles of wine, and it was like it was pretty much effortless. You know, people would find each other and talk to each other, and I was ready to hang up my hat when, you know, I'd gotten to the point where like some of the people who, you know, had met at my things were now better friends with each other than they were with me. And I was like, great, mission accomplished. And then coronavirus hit and I have not been able to do one of these things, you know, for fear of being cited with a misdemeanor for like 6 months now, 7 months now. But it was really fun. And it's like, it has definitely been, you know, it took me a while to like find direction again during my postdoc anyway. Like the lab that I was in moved to Boston halfway through, so I had to switch. I don't know. I mean, it was a very good investment of time and effort, you know, like not just for like, you know, things that you get back from it.
Right.
Because like, I'm happy, right? There are like so many people around. Like I broke my arm recently and it's just been, you know, I don't feel like I'm in a foreign country alone and there's nobody to take care of me or whatever. Right. Like, I'm just like, okay, I have like 20 favors I can call, you know, and I don't even need to because like, you know, it's just nice. It's like, it's nice having a, So after coronavirus, we like set up a little like neighborhood community, which is like, you know, the people who all live within like 2 or 3 blocks of here, from the people who would like come to my dinners. And that's been great, right? Like we've been like kind of like meeting up one-on-one and supporting each other and, you know, coming to check up on each other. And it's as important as the work, I would say.
You need that sanity preservation, that perspective. That's one thing I always really appreciate. When I meet someone who you know, but I don't know yet, I'm like, oh, well, I'm really excited because I have no idea who this person is. Like, it always keep me guessing. It's like, I'm going to learn something from the people I meet through your parties. So it's always a pleasure. So thank you for throwing them people. when we are able to be with others.
Yeah, I'm glad other people got something out of it too because it was very selfish.
it was very, I think healthy, healthy motivation. So Well, I think with that, this has been so much fun, Secret. Thank you for being willing to be a guinea pig.
Yeah, no, this was amazing. I really had fun too.
And I look forward to interviewing you again to hear the second installation update of your postdoctoral
when I
research.
I actually have to justify my existence and like, you know, tell you like what it is that I actually do, except, you know, sitting around in bed all day nursing my arm back to health.
Yeah, so we'll have to do that one. But thank you again, Secret.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me, Tess.
Awesome.
Yay.
We did it.
Clap.
Oh, that was so much fun.
That was really fun.
Okay.
Oh, wait. Oh, shit. Just stop.